love can make a woman feel wanted, secure, complete. But if she's scorned, love can turn toxic. A virtuous beauty takes a cad to task.
She was out of her mind. She had lost her virtue, and that would make a woman crazy.
A teacher's aide gives lessons in murder.
Still there? It's all there.
It was like a kettle on the boil. It was going to explode.
And a love triangle ends in brutality.
Go away.
You have a woman killer. You have a woman mastermind. You have a woman who wanted this done.
These deadly women can't accept being jilted. Their hurt and anger festers until they commit eternal revenge. When a woman's virtue is everything.
She had been violated. She'd been seduced.
Losing it can be a disgrace.
She was severely damaged. She didn't want to live anymore.
And a reason for revenge.
You destroyed me and my future. Now it's your turn to be destroyed.
Los Angeles, 1878. Every day is a party for Chico Forster. He belongs to one of California's wealthiest Hispanic families.
They are elite. They are the 1%, the royalty of Hispanic California.
Chico has everything he wants in life, except a good reputation.
He was a womanizer, considered something of a cad. He liked to gamble, and he was not the most reliable character when it came to his interactions with women.
Mi corazón será tu show.
Polite society frowns on Chico's conquests. But a man of means can always find company. The latest beauty to catch his eye is 18-year-old Lastania Abarta.
Abarta was a beautiful half-Basque, half-Mexican woman.
She came from what we might call, I suppose, a lower middle-class family. Her father owned a billiard parlor, and occasionally she worked there.
Lastania has been raised to be honorable, respectable.
That was beautiful.
Lastania was not an educated woman, and she didn't come from money. All she had was her virtue.
For a photograph with me?
My mother would never allow that. Sorry.
If she lost it, society would probably find out, and she'd be shunned. No one would want her.
Chico becomes a model suitor.
You have a beautiful home.
Thank you.
Brought you a gift.
But his timing is off.
Forster ignored the fact that Lastania was engaged.
Mother, may I introduce Mr. Forster?
And his ill repute makes him an unsuitable candidate in the eyes of Lastania's mother.
You, senor, are wasting your time.
Mother.
Lastancia is already engaged to a lawyer.
Lastania's mother didn't like Forster, basically because he had a reputation as a playboy and something of a rounder.
Now, I would like you both to leave my home and do not come back. Comprende?
Chico was a very selfish man. He wanted everything. He wanted every woman. He didn't care about what was in it for them or what they were risking.
Chico secretly courts Lastania under the watchful eye of her sister, Hortensia.
We will live in a beautiful house and have beautiful babies.
Chico, you know I can't. I'm promised to my mother.
Don't marry that black Indian.
He knew that she was engaged to a highly regarded member of the community, but Forster called him a monkey. And Forster told her once that, why do you want to marry that dirty Indian?
Lastanya falls for his charms, but won't be his mistress. But Chico makes an offer too good to refuse.
Chico told Lastanya on Friday evening that she should leave her house and go with him. That they would go to Tucson, Arizona together and get married there. They would run away and elope.
What are you doing here?
I couldn't stay away. You are all I think of. I want to marry you. Come with me. I have carriage.
He even brings proof of his good intentions, a marriage license.
It was so difficult to seduce a young girl and take her virginity at that point that he had to resort to the only thing that he knew she would respond to, which was a promise of marriage.
In the 1880s, a proposal of marriage can't be broken.
The honor code was important. People kept their word. You make a promise, you keep it.
Lastanya, being young and not having any experience with men, believed everything Chico said.
Chico books a suite in a swanky hotel.
They went to the hotel not for the purpose of having sex, but just to have a place to spend the night until they left the next day. At least that was Lastanya's view.
Tomorrow they wed.
Where will you sleep?
The bed here with you.
But Chico is keen to sample the perks of marriage tonight.
Tomorrow, yes. Until we are married tomorrow, we can share a bed, but not a moment before.
It was very important in the social mores of the time that she not surrender her virginity.
Lastanya's virtue is impregnable, but Chico won't give in. He keeps her locked in the hotel room for two nights. He wants his way. It's time for blunt threats.
Where have you been?
I've been out looking for someone to marry us.
For 3 days?
I think for Chico, getting Lastanya in bed was a conquest. It was a power trip, and there was nothing was gonna stop him.
Hey! Been here for 3 days and three nights. What do you think people are saying? Your reputation is ruined unless you marry me. Come to bed with me or I won't marry you.
Lastanya succumbed and she gave up her virginity to Chico.
Stop crying. Shut up!
Chico's mission is complete. Now Lastanya is just another conquest. One more notch on his bedpost.
The morning after Chico had had sex with Lastanya, she was utterly and completely mortified to find that he had gone. He promised to marry her that morning, but he wasn't anywhere around.
She had nowhere to turn, and she became desperate.
And a desperate woman has the capacity to do dangerous things. In Los Angeles, 1881, there is shock in the Abarta household. Youngest daughter, 18-year-old Lastanya, has eloped with California's most notorious cad, Chico Forster, on the promise of marriage.
She said she's coming back, Mama.
She is not setting foot in this house again.
Instead, he rapes and abandons her, ruining her reputation.
Her mother's reaction to the fact that LaStanya had been staying in a hotel with Forster was very harsh.
But he says he's going to marry her.
He has no intentions of marrying her. Don't you understand?
She told LaStanya that unless she could come back and tell her mother that she was married to Forster, that she didn't want to see her anymore.
Can you show me how it works?
I can do that, man. Yes.
Abandoned by her lover, rejected by her mom, LaStanya is pushed to the edge. She buys a gun. LaStanya has no one to turn to and nothing to live for.
She honestly felt that by losing her virginity through the fraud of Forster, that she was severely damaged, even to the point where she didn't want to live anymore.
But she has one ally, her sister, Hortensia.
Just as she was about to commit suicide, her sister, Hortensia, asked her what was wrong. And LaStanya explained that she'd been abandoned by Forster after he'd taken her virginity, and that she didn't want to live anymore.
Hortensia is determined to restore her sister's honor and make the lying cad live up to his promise.
He had given his word to marry. That was a contract. That was a bond. That was a moral obligation. When he violated it, he had totally violated the honor code of both the South and Hispanic California.
March 16th, 1881. Finding Chico isn't hard. Changing his immoral ways is.
Hortensia was talking to Chico about, why have you abandoned my sister? Are you going to marry her or not? What are you doing?
Chico insists he has every intention of making LaStanya an honest woman.
What are you doing here?
You really think you could get away with this, Chico?
I have every intention of marrying her. I just haven't been able to find anybody that can do it yet.
Well, it looks like you're in luck then. Found someone who will marry you.
Hortensia calls his bluff.
Now, Chico, now.
She has lined up a priest and a church. Smooth-talking Chico finds another excuse to delay the wedding.
So LaStanya knew that he wasn't going to marry her after all. He was going to take her back home.
I will take her to Tucson and marry her there, but not here. Not now. Not like this.
At this point, LaStanya knows she has been wronged. She knew she'd been wronged the day before, or she suspected it, when she purchased a handgun.
LaStanya lost her honor to this scoundrel and has been humiliated twice.
She had been violated, she'd been seduced, she'd been coerced, and once she'd been wronged, she had a right to get vengeance. She draws down and shoots him through the right eyeball at 10 feet. Not a bad shot for a person who allegedly had never used a handgun.
Forster got exactly what he deserved. He had taken this girl's virginity, one of the most important things that she had, by means of fraudulent inducements. He tricked her into it. He told her a lie when he never intended to marry her.
LaStanya has just one regret. She only fired once.
Stop! What are you doing? Hey!
LaStanya was amazingly calm and collected after she had shot Forster. She had what some witnesses called an icy demeanor.
I think LaStanya developed a sense of inner peace about the murder because she believed she did the right thing for her. You hurt me. You destroyed me and my future. Now it's your turn to be destroyed.
But revenge has consequences. LaStanya is charged with homicide. She claims she doesn't remember what happened.
She can't remember anything. She can remember hearing a shot, but remembers nothing else. And of course, as the trial develops, we find out why that's true.
It was believed that women who lost their virtue could become so psychologically affected that they may not be responsible for their actions. They might even go insane.
An all-male jury takes pity. In April 1881, Lastania Abarta is found not guilty by reason of insanity.
When that verdict was given, Lastania stood up, raised her arms over her head as if to thank the heavens. And everyone present applauded. It was a very popular verdict.
Lastania was not crazy. There's no signs of mental illness. If this happened today, she probably would be convicted of murder and possibly given life without parole. Lastania got away with murder. Make no mistake about it.
With her name restored, Lastania finds a new, honorable man and lives happily ever after.
I'm filing for divorce.
When a woman who likes total control,
she felt embarrassed and angry and bitter,
stands to lose everything.
Belongs to my first wife.
Well, it's mine.
She relished the fight. That's what made her happy.
She can come out fighting.
He was just petrified of this woman.
I tell you, 1979, Jefferson, Wisconsin. A romantic dinner to celebrate a new relationship and a fresh start. 25-year-old Reuben Borchardt has fallen for an older woman. 31-year-old Diane Pfister.
Like these don't scare you off?
God, no, I love kids.
Diane set her sights on snaring Reuben, and she went after him with everything that she had.
Must be so hard for you.
Loving attention is just what Reuben needs. Life has been tough since the sudden death of his wife.
Kids keep me going.
His wife, Susan, was the light of his life, and she died tragically in a car accident.
Grief-stricken, Reuben struggles to raise his two children on his own.
Diane and Reuben got together very quickly after Susan's death. I think part of it was because Reuben needed some help. I mean, he had two small children. They needed a mother. But also, I think it was because Diane wanted him.
It leads to marriage and a child of their own, daughter, Regan. For 14 years, they run a busy household. Reuben is a carpenter. Diane is a teacher's aide at the local high school.
The teachers liked her because she was always willing to help and this and that.
Oh, you printed the shirts, miss?
I certainly did, Doug. Here, have a look.
A lot of the teenagers really liked Diane. They nicknamed her Mrs. B.
17-year-old Doug Vest and Joshua Yankee, 16, take a particular shine to Diane.
The kids described her as that person that they would go to share their troubles and their emotions and their feelings, and that she would be open to that.
Her new family knows a very different Diane.
Hurry up and clear the table. I've been asking.
A cold woman who airbrushes out the children's late mother.
What a lot of people didn't see was what I call her dark side.
Can you do that a bit faster?
Diane was controlling the environment. There were no pictures of Susan in the house.
What happened to the photo of mother that used to be here?
I got rid of it.
There was no discussion about Susan in the house.
Why?
Because she's no longer a part of your lives anymore.
The reality that Diane wanted those kids to have was that they didn't have another mother. It was just Diane.
Dad, she's taking the photo away.
It wasn't enough that she be the stepmom. She had to obliterate the memory of their first mother.
She's trying to make us forget.
Diane is not only jealous of a dead woman. She also resents raising Susan's children, Chuck and Brooke.
By the time she had her own child, Regan, she quickly turned all of her attention to Regan. Chuck and Brooke got no attention. In fact, they were almost penalized for even existing.
Get on with it!
Two older kids could see that Regan was the recipient of Diane's undying love.
Diane's behavior is becoming more controlling and erratic.
Diane wanted it her way all the time, 24/7.
Too bad I'm going.
Reuben didn't have a chance. He had to follow exactly what Diane wanted or suffer the consequences, and he suffered some big ones.
Oh, come on, squeeze hard. I'll show the cops the bruises.
She would call the police and say, Reuben is assaulting me. And in actuality, she was the one that was assaulting Reuben.
Far from the tender woman he thought he'd married, Diane is now a woman to fear.
He was afraid that in the process of beating him up, she would somehow turn that against him and he would have to spend time in jail for beating her up when that wasn't the truth.
Reuben knew he was in trouble with Diane. He knew she was violent. He knew he was in danger.
In Jefferson City, 1993, Diane Borchardt's violent outbursts and mind games push her husband Reuben to the brink. He has an exit strategy.
Reuben knew that he couldn't stay any longer. In fact, he'd actually found somebody new. He found a girl named Judy that he'd rather be with.
Jesus, your son.
Thanksgiving is a precious family time. But this year, Reuben drops a bombshell.
While we're all here, I need to tell you something. I'm filing for divorce.
He announced to her and the family that he wanted a divorce, that he was going to marry Judy, and that's when everything started, and there it went downhill from after that.
You gonna break up our family?
But Diane's not leaving Reuben or their home without a fight.
You think our children are better off?
She files for custody of the stepchildren. She's always neglected.
She might have wanted the house. She wanted the children. She didn't want to be the loser when it came to that marriage. She wanted to be the winner.
But she is the loser. Reuben gets custody of his children and the marital home. The court rules that Diane must leave their house by April the 15th.
After a 14-year marriage, she was looking at getting nothing, and it fueled the fire.
Reuben becomes terrified of what his wife could do next.
I think Reuben was scared to death of Diane. He would line the steps with mayonnaise jars, empty jars, as a sort of alarm system in case Diane might come down and harm him.
She had said that she was going to cut his penis off with a knife. And he was afraid of that.
Come down.
So all of these things made him terrified.
What's up, man? She's getting worse. You think you're scared? She threatened to cut my penis off.
If she couldn't have Reuben, if he didn't want her, no one else was going to have him either.
On the verge of losing everything, Diane has to do something radical.
Miss, are you all right?
Diane was a classic manipulator.
I'm going through a divorce.
She told them that she was beaten by her husband and that she was fearful for her life.
He hasn't hit you, has he?
She picked out victims like a lion picks out prey, the weak and the vulnerable. She went for kids who came from troubled homes that had something missing in their life. And she stepped in to fulfill that.
She lures teenagers Doug Vest and Joshua Yankee into her dark world with a promise of cash, cars, and jewelry. They recruit an even younger boy.
It's all there.
15-year-old Michael Maldonado.
Doug Vest and Mike Maldonado were to go into the house, go down and shoot Ruben, and Josh Yonke was to stay upstairs, unhook the phone, and take care of Chuck Borkhardt, Ruben's son, if he came out of the bedroom.
On April 2nd, 1994, Easter Eve, Diane starts a fight with Ruben.
You're not taking that. It belongs to my first wife.
Well, it's mine.
Give it to me. Give it to me now.
No.
She tried to get Ruben to hit her.
Get it off me! What are you doing?
My arm!
Well, when he threw her down, he did cause a bruise on her arm.
I'm calling the cops!
And the police come out and they advise her to leave, that this is a volatile situation, you need to leave.
Diane has what she wants, official witnesses to her and daughter Regan leaving the house.
What Diane was doing really was establishing an alibi and kind of establishing it in a clever way. She wanted everyone to know she wasn't going to be there that Easter.
The next morning, Easter Sunday, Chuck is sound asleep. His sister Brooke is staying over at a friend's. Reuben is up early to attend church, but Diane has another plan for him.
These two were coming down the steps, and Reuben came around the corner, and there he was, and that's the first time that they shot him. Chuck crept to the stairs and looked down and around, and here he saw his father laying across a chair with blood all over.
He is in very bad shape, but he is able to say something to his son. And he says to Chuck, I can't believe she did this to me.
Who did this to you?
The teen killers flee. Reuben is rushed to the hospital, but dies later that day. The timing of Reuben's murder, less than 2 weeks before Diane must move out of the home, makes her the number one suspect.
I think people closest to Diane and Reuben within the family did suspect Diane right away. They had no doubt.
But we also knew that she could not have physically pulled a trigger because she was 3 hours away.
Diane thinks she's committed the perfect murder. But when Reuben's life insurance payout is frozen, she can't pay the boys, and they start talking.
Diane's big mistake was over-promising the boys and under-delivering, and they turned on her.
Doug Vest confesses to police. He and Michael Maldonado are convicted of first-degree murder and receive life. Joshua Yonke pleads guilty to second-degree intentional homicide and gets 18 years in prison.
I think the most shocking part of this crime are all the wasted lives, all the young people's lives that were touched by Diane's evil.
On August 1st, 1995, Diane Borchardt is sentenced to life for first-degree murder. She must serve 40 years before she's eligible for parole.
Teenagers don't know the first thing about murder or how to get away with it. Neither did Diane, and that is why she is in prison. Diane is a very selfish woman who only cared for what she wanted in life. A lot of people's lives were hurt or destroyed because of what Diane wanted for herself.
A cheating lover can break a heart.
No way.
All the way around, love triangles can be very, very dangerous.
But a vengeful lover.
She was the mastermind. She was the brains behind this horrific murder.
Can steal a life.
They dragged her into the bedroom. She died a really awful death.
Some sometimes in life, everything seems to fall into place. It does for 31-year-old Marcella Whaley and her lover, Kimberlyn Estrada, when they arrive in Las Vegas in 2000.
Marcella Whaley was a pretty woman from Mexico and had a long-time relationship with a gal for 6 years and was a self-described lesbian.
The couple needs somewhere to live.
There's really not much around.
Oh, hey, I have a room.
Where is it?
Just down the road.
Great.
As luck has it, their waitress, fellow Mexican, Satsi Sanchez, has a room to rent.
Satsi was a beautiful girl. She was young, vibrant, and she had her whole future ahead of her. She was also very energetic and somewhat of a risk taker.
Waiting tables is a way for 27-year-old Satsi to make money while in college.
Satsi moved to the United States to attend college, and she enrolled at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and her father, who was wealthy, wanted her to have a nice place to live, and so he got her this great big house.
Marcella doesn't only move in to Satsi's home with her lover.
Can you go down and get us some more tequila?
She plans to move in on Satsi.
Marcella was a very strong personality, and she knew what she wanted. And what she did is she would target women that she wanted to flip or turn into lesbians, into her lovers.
This is new territory for Satsi. Until this point, she's strictly heterosexual.
For Satsi to suddenly flip and go from a heterosexual lifestyle to a lesbian lifestyle was very daring and very big on her part, because that was just not necessarily accepted back home where she was. When Kimberlyn discovered that there was a relationship going on between Satsi and Marcella, she decided to move out of the house.
With Kimberlyn out of the picture, everything should be rosy. But Marcella soon shows her true colors.
Within weeks, the relationship sours.
Where are you going?
I'm just gonna go meet some friends to study. Friends,
you're not going anywhere. You are staying right here.
Marcella becomes a lot more controlling.
Right here.
She started controlling the whereabouts and the movements of Satsi.
I don't care. You are not going out yet. Give me a piece.
She was the one who was going to control the relationship. She was also the one who was going to say who she was going to date and what she was going to do with him.
I said no.
Before she hooked up with Marcella, Satsi was strong and independent. Now she's terrified. She turns to the one woman who might understand.
Hey.
She ended up being so controlling that Satsi started getting concerned about herself and started confiding in Kimberlyn.
So how's it going? To tell you the truth, I'm scared of her. I'm scared of what she'll do to me.
But Satsi gets more than advice from Kimberlyn.
They seem to really enjoy themselves, that she was very happy and that she was very content in this relationship.
I really
and it was so much more different than what she had experienced in the relationship with Marcella.
You're okay.
Marcella has been duped at her own game. She's lost control over not one, but two lovers.
I think Marcella was the kind of person who felt entitled. She felt entitled to Kimberlyn. She felt entitled to moving on over to another girl, but she didn't want anybody else to do that.
Marcella could not tolerate a lover leaving her. It cut her to the core. It caused her a lot of pain. The only way for Marcella to stop the pain was to kill the object that she believed was causing the pain.
To help the pain go away, Marcella uses an acquaintance, Luis Barroso.
This is the house. And afterwards, you can have me.
Luis Barroso was her easy target. Luis Barroso was not necessarily God's gift to women. And here you suddenly have a very attractive female in Marcella coming to Luis Barroso and asking him, can you do this for me? And by the way, I've never slept with a man, but I want to sleep with you. I could see how that could have been intoxicating to an idiot.
January 14th, 2001. The housemates gather for a party. Marcella wants to win back her first love, but Kimberlyn isn't buying.
Her reaction to Kimberlyn getting involved with Tsotsi was just over the top.
But Tsotsi is no longer afraid of Marcella.
I'm with Tsotsi now.
Bullies are no longer welcome.
How dare you do this, Marcella?
I think it infuriated Marcella, the fact that Kimberlyn was not coming into bed with her.
You're moving out.
You get caught up in a love triangle and you've got somebody who's off balance. It's a recipe for disaster, and in this case, it was a recipe for murder.
Las Vegas, 2001. Three girls are caught in a love triangle. 31-year-old Marcella Whaley is on the outs, but she has a plan for revenge.
When some people murder, they don't want to get their hands dirty. So they'll get someone else to do it for them.
Early next morning, Kimberlyn Estrada leaves for work. Her lover, Tsotsi Sanchez, has no idea what's in store. The scorned lover has seduced Luis Barroso and a pal, Obed Marroquin, into murder.
They pounded on top of her. They began beating her about the face. They grabbed an electrical cord from one of the electrical appliances that she had inside her bedroom, cut the cord and used that to hogtie her. They started ripping off her clothes.
Come on, turn her!
While her thugs brutalize her rival, Marcella makes sure she is seen out and about.
At this point, Luis Barroso and or Obed Marroquin decided that they were going to assault her sexually.
The attack was prolonged, and it was particularly vicious. She was helpless. She was completely at their mercy.
It's a pitiful case. It's sad. The fact that she was a student and opened her house to people and she ended up dead as a result. It's a sad story. It's a pitiful end to a life that was blossoming.
The killers leave a sick memento, a ticket stub from a romantic movie.
That's very telling because Luis Barroso and Obed Marroquin clearly knew that she was a lesbian. And these two sick individuals went with the idea that they were going to show what a man can do to a woman.
The amateur hitmen make a fatal mistake. They steal Tsotsi's possessions and brag to co-workers how they got them.
The police quickly executed a search warrant on Luis Barroso's home, and at that point, they discovered some of the items.
The two men turn on Marcella, and police issue a warrant for her arrest. But she's already fled the country to Mexico.
Being the woman killer that she was, she knew darn well that she had a very limited time to get out of Las Vegas before the truth came out.
But But Marcella's not in hiding. She's in the public eye every night as a reporter on TV news.
She, like so many other people who commit murders, they think they got away with it. But they think they're smarter than everybody else.
Most people that murder someone that they know don't go get a job on television where tens of thousands, if not millions of people will see them. Not Marcella. She didn't care who saw her. She wanted the world to see her.
Despite her high profile, Las Vegas prosecutors are powerless to arrest her.
Under the treaties with the United States, Mexico will not extradite, by law, their nationals back to the United States if they're facing death penalty.
Authorities can't crack her international protection. But they bring her accomplices to justice. In 2004, Luis Barroso and Obeid Marroquin are found guilty and receive life sentences. Marcella thinks she's home free, but what she doesn't realize is by killing a Mexican national, she is accountable to Mexican law.
The Mexican police actually decided to investigate the Las Vegas crime. The Las Vegas prosecutors and the police opened up their files and they investigated, and then they charged her with murder in Las Vegas, and she was convicted in Mexico. It's unprecedented.
Marcella is finally brought to justice in November 2005. She receives 37 years in a Mexican prison.
I can tell you a Mexican prison is not as nice as a Nevada prison. She's doing hard time in a Mexican prison.
Many think it is a just reward for betraying a woman Marcella claimed to love.
I can only wonder how much Marcella really did ever love Tsatsi, or what in the world kind of love that would have been. She had no empathy, no feelings for another person, which is what made this crime so easy for her to do.
These three women had very different motives for murder. Lestania Abarta shot a cad to save her honor. Diane Borchardt's greed left children without a father. And Marcella Whaley's insane jealousy saw her lover murdered. These deadly women wanted eternal revenge.